Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining assistant editor Lee Boyce and I today is reporter George Nixon. And coming up, the intergenerational financial divide is back in the news. And Lee, I'm afraid it doesn't look good for you and I. But are older generations really living it up at the expense of the young? There are concerns about the pressures facing the bank of mum and dad. Also today, a warning to savers, Marcus is back. And would you pay a premium for a metal debit card? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, bad news for two-thirds of the people in this studio. Yes, Lee, it is you and I. Because while the expectation is that every generation has it better than the one before, alas, that is not the case for those born in the 80s. Just want to double check, Lee, you were born in the 80s.
I was born in the 80s, Georgie.
And just want to check, George, you were not.
I was not.
Oh, wow. Anyway, so this is all according to a landmark report by the Office for National Statistics that have shown we're about £800 worse off a year than those born a decade before. Whereas those lucky 1970s kids have £7,000 more than those born in the 60s. Okay, right, Lee.
Mm-hmm.
What's all this about?
Well, Georgie, if it's the first time that the Office for National Statistics has released data on intergenerational earnings, and it follows a recommendation from a House of Lords committee to publish this information and let people know how they compare to previous generations.
Well, what's the point of this?
There's been a lot, I would say, especially since the financial crisis, about you think about people born in the 50s, 60s and 70s, about how much more money allegedly they have than people from the 1980s onwards. Again, you know, thanks largely to the financial crisis that rocked the world economy. It's hard to quantify, but are we worse off than other generations? Now, as a rule of thumb, each generation, generally speaking, expects to be better off than the one before. And that's true of healthcare, education, standard of living and income. So, yeah, you know, that's how it's been for a very long time. You expect incomes to increase as generations go through the years. I'm actually reading a book at the moment, Yuval Noah Harari. So he did Homo Sapiens, which is
I've read both of them, Lane.
Yeah, I've read all of them, and he's got new, he's
no,
got
I've read all of them.
I've read all of them. I'm on book three.
George, so, have you?
I've not read any of them.
No,
when you're older.
His third book, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, and in there was quite a poignant quote. I think it says, during the latter part of the 20th century, each generation, whether in Houston, Shanghai, Istanbul, or Sao Paulo, enjoy better education, superior healthcare, and large incomes than the one that came before it. In coming decades, however, owing to a combination of technological disruption and ecological meltdown, the younger generation might be lucky just to stay in place. Now, what he means by that and what the theme of that chapter of the book is about how technology, robots stealing jobs, basically, might impact how we live in future years. And it's going to be it's going to be a bigger strain on people, perhaps, in the coming decades. Not necessarily true, but we are used to better standard of living and more income as time goes on, yeah, as a Western country. Now, what this ONS data actually shows is that it appears not to be the case. And actually, this divide now looks like it is happening and it could get bigger. In this country, a lot of it's to do with property prices. That's where a lot of that intergenerational divide comes, and a lot of that kind of friction comes in. Oh, you managed to buy a house when prices were low, and now you're sitting on this big property. How am I going to get on the property ladder? I think that's what a lot of this boils down to. But the ONS data here, a lot of this is about earnings and it's about income.
It's not all about, and yes, you're talking about earnings and income, but it's not really all about the house prices. I mean, if you're talking about health, for example, you know, we have a larger population.
Mm-hmm. You know, an older population.
Mm-hmm. It's growing. But also other areas are covered that perhaps weren't in the past. Mental health.
Yeah, it's true.
And those sorts of issues. And these things have to be paid for.
Yeah.
So actually, maybe it's the way that we look at things in terms of if we do want to have, and I would expect to have better advanced healthcare, mm-hmm, you know, in the coming years than in the past, that these things are going to have to be paid for.
Definitely.
I think in terms of technology and robots stealing our jobs, new opportunities may come around.
Which is what the book says, you know, that's what he sort of gets into. But I just thought that was quite a pertinent quote about the income situation, which is what is in this ONS report.
But my thing about the ONS report, and you also have another article on your website doesn't it stoke up a little bit of bad feeling between generations? And Lee, you did mention that with house prices. George, I want to bring you in because you are the youngest person in the room. And actually, I should point out, while we're talking about the 80s, what's the it look like for the 90s?
Not to blow my own trumpet as the representative of like the Britpop generation, as it were, but it appears as if
we're what you're being called now.
Well, a self-styled thing.
All right, okay.
I don't remember any of it. The case is that there's sort of been a kind of correction, and if you dig into the data further, there's a really interesting chart, which is that what the ONS found is that because your earnings are highest in your 20s, in 1985 onwards, really, the point at which your income is supposed to increase by the most coincides right with the financial crisis in 2008, and following that, what they call a lost decade in terms of poor productivity, poor wage growth. So there's, behind our offices, there is a plaque to William Makepeace Thackeray, who was born in 1811. That is the last time wage growth has been this bad as it has been over the last 10 years. Napoleonic Wars, the 19th century, that is the last time that it has
been
as bad.
The youngest kid in the room, but the most historically engaged. Wow.
Yeah.
Well done.
So that's a really interesting stat to tuck around. And what you see with the UK labour market is normally in a financial crisis and a recession, you'd expect unemployment to spike. UK employment, labour market remain incredibly tight, but what you saw is just really poor wage growth, really poor productivity, and a lot of growth in self-employment. That's really affected people. So while income sort of depressed among all age groups from between 2008 and 2018, really, because those born in the 80s were hit hardest at the point at which they'd expected to be earning the most, that's why they've been the worst off.
And what so things don't look so bad for you, depending on how Brexit
exactly.
goes,
obviously. Exactly. So I started secondary school in...
And other issues.
Yeah, exactly. So I started secondary school in 2008, just as the financial crisis hit. And I came out of uni basically the other side of this kind of lost decade. So I was kind of sheltered, as it were, from that thing. So
I wonder if you're going to be more... I mean, obviously, you're a financial journalist, but your generation is a little bit more savvy about it than perhaps other generations.
I don't know. I think so much of it is macro as well. I think a lot of the case, and when we come on to talk about intergenerational stuff, is there's this question of whether people deserve blame for basically benefiting from economy-wide changes and this sort of thing, like rising house prices. How much blame do individual people deserve for that? In terms of us,
well,
I think it's...
None, presumably, isn't there?
Well,
is it?
No.
Blame is probably not the right word.
Probably.
So, I mean, blame is an interesting word because I think that's where the narrative... has become.
I guess, I think also...
But was this done in the view that policy decisions would be made to target those people who are to blame or who have earned, with benefit to those of us, Lee, who were born in the 80s?
Perhaps. I think also it's a way of better informing people about... You know, like I said, this is a really landmark piece of research because it's something that people have been crying out for more often, this kind of data on different age cohorts, and it is interesting to see it throughout different age periods. Whether any policy changes on it, there is an awareness now of sort of student loan debt, which is something disproportionately will affect my generation rather than yours. Sort of like pension stuff, things like citizens' inheritance. There's loads of kind of potentially like quirky policy things being talked about. I mean, pension savings and that sort of thing.
Lee?
Well, I'll draw a bit more into the details of this, George, actually. So it was based on 5,000 families across 8 decades from the 20s to the 90s, and it uses inflation-adjusted data on household incomes after tax. And what the ONS actually said in the report was, unlike previous generations at each age, households with heads born in the 1980s have broadly comparable median incomes to those born the previous decade. They have also seen slower growth in income between 25 and 34 compared with those born in the 1960s and 1970s at the same age. Now, what that means, someone at the age of 31 who was born in the 70s would have had 26% more disposable income than someone born in the 1960s. That's a sizable leap in disposable income, whereas someone born in the 1980s at the same age would have 1% less than the generation before, which is very unusual. I mean, that's quite a startling fact. That's quite a huge discrepancy, and it's all basically really down to the financial crisis. I mean, that's what the ONS is saying, and it's saying that its wages and salaries have fared worse than historical trends. And to go back to what George was saying, you know, you have to go back to the start of the 19th century to see such low wage growth, and that does put a substantial amount of pressure on people that are born in the 1980s, I think what the research is saying is not saying that when you're in your 20s, that's when you earn the most. It's when you make the biggest leap, because you go from, most people these days go to university, but that's not always the case. You know, a lot of people do come out of school 18 and get jobs, but it's that, usually that's the biggest boost. You go from ground zero, you're at zero, and by the time you start your 20s, let's say you start on £20,000, but by the time you finish your 20s, you know, you kind of, hopefully, are earning a sizable more amount than that. So you've gone from naught to, say, 30 grand, you know, very quickly, and then after that, it usually slows down a bit. So it doesn't make for great reading.
I'm listening to this and realising, you know, what you're talking about there is people who've had a normal trajectory.
Yeah, you know, and that doesn't always happen. And what's normal? I mean, people have all sorts of career breaks and gap years.
I was
going to
say,
you know, it's very hard to quantify.
During my life, I have my own sort of double whammy. And exactly that same time, I couldn't work for over a year because of a back operation. So then I was be doubly hit. But it does go to show that even if you were perhaps 70s or 90s or whatever, if you have that kind of pause in your career, it can impact you much later on, obviously.
And the thing is, this is based on 5,000 families, right? So every family's different. It's quite hard. But I mean, that is quite a big representative example of Britain, 5,000 families. But even still, you still get quirks. You still get, you know, things that happen over your course of your life. As you say, you might have to take a year of work, you might have children. It makes it very difficult to really, really nail down. But you know, 5,000 families is pretty comprehensive research.
What do you think they're going to do with this research, though, Lee? Do you think is it just for information purposes?
Just for information purposes.
Policy making time.
Potentially, but I mean, the thing is, what do you do with this information? As in policy decisions. I mean, potentially, people were crying out for it because they kind of wanted to know what.
Well, a justification for things like taking away certain benefits to older people.
Yeah, TV license stuff.
Yeah, it's true. But I mean, it doesn't make great reading for the Conservative government at the moment, does it? You know, it doesn't look good. I don't want to be earning less than the generation before and having less disposable income. It's not great for the economy. It's not great for my own well-being. It adds fuel to the fire.
Well, it's not really the Conservatives' fault, though, because it was a global issue and Labour are in charge at the time.
Yeah,
anyway,
no, it's true. But I mean, as in, they are in charge at the moment, you know, and they've had a decade. And, you know, we'll see if anything has changed when perhaps we get this next report on this. When that is, I don't know. Look, I turned 21 in 2008 when the financial crisis hit. I came out of university. And it was a very, 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 very tough time. It was very difficult. It was probably the worst time to finish university, to come out and try and find a job. But, you know, what that did to me was give me a bit of a boot up the backside. I decided to do an extra year to get my journalism degree, and now I am where I am. What would have happened if the financial crisis didn't bite? Well, I don't know what I'd be doing. I might have been doing a gap year, and then I might have, you know, now probably working in some faceless bank somewhere in the city. You know, it's, but you know what I'm trying to say? Happen, and it has a knock-on effect to everyone. And I think that, personally speaking, I think that this set of data is really interesting. I think it's very good to have it from an official source. And as I say, I'd be really, really super interested when the next data set on this comes out.
Do you think, though, that it's helped stoke up a little bit of sort of ill feeling, should we put it, between the generations? Because, like I said, there's an article on your website, some research, 2/3 of older people say that they feel pretty hurt by this criticism, this idea that they're lording it up. And actually, stories always used to be in the past, you know, pensioners in poverty. Well, isn't it good that we're not having those stories anymore?
Yeah, it's true. I think, so basically there was this research from Saga, the voice of the over 55s. You know, a lot of people are saying that it's unfair to say that the elderly enjoy a disproportionate share of society's financial advantages. And actually, 4 in 5 people of older people feel saddened by intergenerational conflict. You can totally see why, can't you? I mean, most people have children, grandchildren. It's been portrayed as like pitting people against each other. There's a good quote from Saga in this research, and it says, "The sad truth is that those baby boomers who are accused of hoarding houses or being criticised for benefiting from house price growth over the years actually had little direct control over the economics that led to these increases." That makes a whole lot of sense to me. And there's a lecturer actually at Canterbury Christchurch University who says, "I'm concerned about how vicious this debate is becoming. Findings such as these from Saga indicate that older and younger generations are not at war with each other, and I hope that this can help counteract the stereotypes and scaremongering." A lot of people bought a home in the 60s, 70s and 80s to live in. They didn't buy a home and go, oh, yeah, I mean, this is going to be my retirement fund and I know that house prices are going to go up, you know, X percent.
It depends where you live. It depends on your circumstances.
Exactly. And, like, you know, the danger of being very London and South East focused. And, you know, around the country, it's a different picture, you know, everywhere. And, you know, this Saga research said that 85%, this is over 55s who were researched for this, said that they believe that older generations should help younger relatives if they were in a position to do so. And 68% thought young people have opportunity to good or better. So, you know, a section of older people think that younger people have it better than they had in their day. And you can argue.
I would rather be in my day now.
Yeah, exactly.
I was born in the 80s with the opportunities, with the healthcare, with everything we've got going.
We're incredibly lucky. We're incredibly lucky. Whatever era you were born in, we're incredibly lucky to be living in this country, in society. Like, you know, with everything aside, Brexit and all the nonsense that's going on, we're very fortunate to live in a prosperous country. And I totally agree with what Saga's saying this. You can't pit people against each other because of house prices. You know, it's just they haven't been directly responsible for it, and it's not necessarily reflective of the whole country. Other parts of the country haven't seen house price growth go up to massive levels.
Can I take a slightly more controversial line as the youngest person? In terms of, while, like, yeah, I mean, people shouldn't be rowing about this, it shouldn't be kind of pitting people against each other. There is an extent that, like, when the government is allocating what to spend money on, that it guarantees the triple lock on pensions. So, by the way, don't let anyone ever tell you that the Conservative government is not in favour of redistribution of wealth, because that is exactly what the triple lock is. And if you want to see the power of the pensions lobby, it's the fact that Jeremy Corbyn is also in favour of keeping the triple lock. But the fact is that, like, a government agreeing to do that means, for example, that it might take choices elsewhere, like cutting benefits for working families. So at the bottom of that chart, I wrote on the intergenerational ONS stuff, is a chart from the Resolution Foundation that shows that working age families have been the most hit by post-2015 benefit cuts. There's also the thing of, you know, it's not me, Gov. It's not my fault about the economy. It's not my fault about government policies. I've just benefited from them. So, like, people who are left-wing, who are on high incomes, vote for higher taxes on themselves out of some kind of sense of, out of ideology. People who voted for Brexit might well be voting to make themselves poorer because they care more about other things. I don't think it's always fair to go, well, that it's always the case that older people can't do anything about this or anything, and that they have no impact on the way that government policy works. The other thing is that so if we go back to the TV licence stuff, I have a lot of debates with my grandma about this. And my grandma's 90 and is now really angry about the prospect of having to pay the TV licence. Whereas I don't have a problem with it, because my thinking is that those who are in pension poverty, as we hear about, don't have to pay it. You know, the people who can't afford to pay it don't need to pay it. It's for people like my grandma, who's, you know, not poor, who's pretty comfortable in retirement as far as you can be, and she doesn't believe that she has to pay it because of paying it all her life. It's like, why do I have to pay it because I'm old? Whereas I'm sort of thinking, I mean, ultimately it's a hard one for the BBC. It's basically the government kicking it over to them and saying, well, you deal with this because we don't want to annoy pensioners by scrapping it, and we'll let them force you to do it instead.
I do think there's an argument for things like bus passes and for TV licence to be means tested. I also think the idea of sort of 60, 65 is far too young to be thinking about sort of things like that, because 60 is the new 40. I mean, that's not old at all, is it? So I get the arguments. What I will say is the idea of the triple lock, so that your pension goes up in line with inflation, 2.5% or wage growth, whichever's higher. I'm sorry, I'm going to defend pensioners' rights to have a safe and comfortable retirement, because anything can happen. You don't know when you're going to need that extra money, et cetera, et cetera. And I am fully, fully supportive of, because we're all probably going to be in that stage, actually, to be fair. But we do wonder whether George will actually have a state pension, to be honest.
Well, yeah,
ask me again in 50 years and I'll probably agree with you.
Suggestion, wasn't there, Lee, that it could raise to 75, people were talking about.
Yeah, so there's been this all over the media in the last couple of weeks, and the Conservative government have had to really sort of try and, you know, step away from this and say this isn't happening. You know, when stuff happens now on the internet, as in, things are just reported as fact, and then they sort of spread like wildfire, and then all of a sudden a think tank saying that 75 should be the retirement age becomes, this is what the Conservative government want to do, then it becomes it's what they are doing, and I can't believe they're doing this, and then it's just outrage, and it goes into this big wildfire.
Labour
just
react with their own policy suggestions.
Yeah, and it's just, and it's absolutely bonkers. So the Centre for Social Justice, which is a right-wing think tank, it's suggested that state pension should be raised to 70 by 2028. I mean, that's not a long way away. And then 75 by 2035. I mean, let's put this into focus right now. The life expectancy of the average Briton is just under 81. Right, so that would give you a whole 6 years to enjoy the state pension that you have probably paid into for 50 plus years to have when you retire. I mean, that is absolutely, in my mind, ludicrous. Yes, life expectancy has broadly gone up, although saying that in the last year or two, it's dipped a little bit. So are we at peak age? Well, you know, healthcare advances and other bits and pieces will probably suggest not, but it's hard to predict what's going to happen. We've already had, not that long ago, the announcement that retirement age is going up, going to be equalised to 68 in our lifetime. So by the time we get state pension, we'll be waiting until we're 68. Could that move? Could the goalpost move further? Who knows? There's a huge funding crisis with state pensions, isn't there, at the end of the day? You know, there's huge pressures on it, and what that state pension will look like when we retire is very difficult to know. You said earlier about means-tested benefits when we're talking about, you know, winter fuel allowance, a TV licence. Where does a government draw a line in the future? Do they? This is the one that scares people, is the means-tested state pension. You know, it's the dreaded thing. We're all encouraged, there's been great strides in this, Georgie, in the last decade, to put us into auto-enrolment, to be saving for our own retirement, to be having a private pension. A lot of people think they're not invested in the stock market when they are. If you've got a pension, you invest in the stock market. As we saw in the financial crisis, you know, it's not great if something like that can really hit your retirement fund. A lot of people rely on the state pension as a real part of their retirement planning. If you're going to keep moving the goalposts, it's going to be very difficult for people to know what they're doing into old age. There's data out there that's saying that forcing Britons to work until their mid-70s may help boost the economy by £182 billion a year. I mean, that's incredible. But that's from people that are having to wait an extra 7 years.
If you're talking about robots as well, what jobs are going to be available for people that...
Well, who knows?
Especially physical jobs. Yeah. You're not going to be able to do it anyway.
And that's the thing. So, you know, it's crazy. Roz Altman, who was a pensions minister for a short time.
This,
no, I mean, she said, she said the idea is chilling and immoral, which thought was quite strong. So at the moment, state pensions, £168.60 a week. I had a quick look, actually, to see what retirement ages are in other countries. I could find one that was 70 or over, and that was like Libya or somewhere, I think. But the broad line is most Western economies it is somewhere between 65 and 68. 68 is what seems to be a lot of countries are phasing in, but there's countries where it's mid-50s to 60, you know, and we all want to have a good retirement. We all pay into the system. We all expect a certain level of state pension. It's not, we pay for it. We pay in for it over our lifetime. It's like one of the key savings accounts, really, if you think about it in that kind of way, that we have to fund our retirement. If you're going to start telling people that, you know, there's going to be a large chunk of people that don't make it to 75. So you're telling me you paid into the system for 50, 55 years, and I passed away at 75 and I didn't have a single minute to enjoy any of the state pension that I built up. I find it very hard. It's very, very unlikely that this is going to come in. I should put a caveat this. Yeah. So this is a think tank paper. These think tanks are always out there. They're always sort of almost doing things that sound a little bit controversial
but
to get in the press.
But it's going with what is sort of the momentum of the day, which is the idea that we are seeing state pension, you know, pushed back. And it's not necessarily the figure that's important. This is what's being discussed at the moment, is the fact that we don't know the future of the state pension.
No.
So the onus, as you always remind us, and we always remind everybody, is to do what you can yourself now.
Don't rely on other people.
Exactly.
Just if your private pension is currently not up to scratch, you need to have a quick look at it. You need to see what you're invested in. You need to have a look at, is all of your exposure in, you know, Britain, You know, it's not a good place to be at the moment to have all of your eggs in one. It's never good to be all your eggs in one basket anyway. But a lot of these default funds will have all of your retirement cash going into one fund. And it'll be, you know, usually largely British companies and then North America a little bit and a mix of stuff around the globe. You need to have a look and diversify a little bit. Sounds scary. It's not. Have a look what's available. Look at the charges that are on there. But also look at what your company is offering. Mm. Is it that you can pay in 3% and then they'll pay in 3%, which is essentially free cash? You get the pensions tax relief on it, and the magic of compounding interest over the years, you give yourself such a more comfortable retirement. I wish when I was George's age that actually, you know, I'm only talking 10 years ago, but if I'd put a little bit away a bit earlier, I just wish I had. And I, you know, my, as only someone that's 10 years older than George, my nugget of wisdom would be just save as much as you can possibly do into your pension, because I am worried about where the future of the state pension is going. I'm not scaremongering. I think it bubbles away in a lot of people's minds. I don't want to make that the main bulk of my retirement planning, because I just don't think it's a sensible option.
Exactly. Before we move on from that, I do want to just talk about, we're talking about intergenerational pressures. We're talking about retirement planning, and we're getting a lot of warnings at the moment about the bank of mum and dad. And to continue with that analogy, you know, if they're opening their doors too wide to the younger generations, they do risk their own retirement.
That's right. So there's been a separate, it's been like an intergenerational couple of weeks of research that seems to have come out. Maybe it's a time of year. We'll have to check back in this time next year to see if it's the same. But basically what Legal & General are saying here is that some parents are having to postpone their own retirement or accept a lower standard of living after basically giving their cash away to their children or grandchildren. Mm. One of the big ones is to give a gift to get money, give money to get their children or grandchildren onto the housing ladder. It's a big pressure at the moment, isn't it, for bank of mum and dad?
Absolutely.
It means that so far it's estimated that £6.3 billion in 2019 is going to be lent to children and grandchildren from the bank of mum and dad, which is the equivalent of a top 10 mortgage lender. In just a matter of a decade, the average contribution from parents towards a deposit has risen from more than £6,000 to £24,000. It's quadrupled, Georgie, in a decade. Earlier, we were talking about, well, it's not their fault that house prices have gone up type attitude. What they're having to do, where house prices have gone up, they're having to, well, not having to, but they are helping their children get onto the housing ladder with those hugely inflated house prices. So it's kind of a weird circle of life. And it's putting massive, massive strain. One in five over 55s are dipping into their savings and pensions because they feel a responsibility to help their children. It's hard. It's very hard to save for a deposit. It's very hard, I would guess, being a parent, seeing your child perhaps struggling renting, perhaps struggling to find a career in which they're earning enough money. And they kind of feel, not obliged, because it's not the right terminology, but out of loving their children, doing what they can to pass on some wealth and help them out. But what it means is that they're having a worse standard of retirement as a result. So selfless.
Also imagine retirement planning might have something to do with that. Perhaps, you know, that whole 7-year inheritance tax thing, maybe some are giving perhaps over a little bit more than...
Perhaps, yeah. But I mean, you are right to mention that. But I would have thought that if we're talking just purely bank of mum and dad giving to their children, it's likely that, you know, your child, as a rule of thumb, when they're kind of looking to buy a house, let's say, again, this, all families are different, we should say this, but, you know, let's say you want to buy a home when you're about 30, most parents will be in the 60s, 70s mark. I don't know if further on beyond that, we start thinking about inheritance tax issues around it. All I will say is that money and families are sometimes the biggest cause of strain and stress that you can imagine. And there's that kind of feeling as someone in their 20s and 30s, sort of, well, house prices have gone up, you've helped fuel this boom, so you give me some money to get on the housing ladder. I think that's an attitude that a lot of people have, and, you know, rightly or wrongly, it's causing a huge strain.
Which goes back to the research as to, while it's incredibly interesting and, you know, historically interesting, particularly for financial journalists and the like, you do wonder whether it sort of stokes up a little bit more ill feeling than... It's not just ill feeling, it's practical. It's having a practical consequence on, you know, mums and dads feeling under pressure to pay...
It's so under pressure, Georgie. And you think about it as well. You know, if you've had a child that's been living with you up until the age of 21 or 18 or whatever... you know, the amount of money it costs to keep a roof over your child's head, to feed them, to clothe them, to take them on holidays, you know, all that sort of thing, it adds up substantially over time. Again, it's a very broad stroke, but it's a lot of money that you're giving up to your child. What I would say, one little parting shot of advice I would say is that as someone who has recently had a child, I am saving very much in the mind of set of when said child turns 18 or 21. I'm tucking away small amounts of money each month. Wife and I are putting a small amount of money away each month into a stocks and shares ISA with that hope to kind of sidestep this issue. You know, when she's old enough and wants to buy a home, I'm hoping that through years and years, it feels so long away, and I think that's what a lot of people don't do this kind of thing, but a couple of decades, I'm hoping to build this pot into a nice sizable deposit or for university so she doesn't have to take a student loan on or whatever she wants to do. But she can't turn around and say that we didn't do enough or give her enough to help her on her way. And if anyone's listening to this and you could got have a spare bit of cash, even if it's £20 a month, it adds up so much over the course. It can give such a boost to a young person once they become an adult.
So to bookend all this, you've got on your website, and I know Simon, wherever he is right this minute now, on holiday somewhere, does love a good poll.
Yes.
You've asked, which do older people enjoy an unfair share of wealth compared to the young, which may be representative of the wider population or may represent the demographic of your readership. Could be one or t'other. For fairness, by the way, I did yes and no, so I could read the answers. And so far, of almost 1,500 votes, we are 20% yes, older people enjoy an unfair share of, so no, 80%.
It broadly represents what the Saga research, you know, the figures in that. We do have a slightly older readership, and probably more older people might have clicked on that story than not.
Okay, let's move on from that and on to a warning this time for savers. This is against locking away their cash. Often is the case because you can get a better rate with an easy access account. Used to be the case, the longer you tied up your cash, the higher the interest rate. But banks and building societies are now slashing rates on longer term deals. So, George, what's going on here?
Yes, so 40% of savings providers cut or withdrew their fixed rate bonds in July, which is a pretty big number. I asked... you're getting a really weird situation now where there are some providers that will offer you comparable or even better rates on easy access products than long-term ones, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
So I asked about this, did a little bit of research for this podcast, as I know we were talking about this story. So what it is basically is that fixed rate products are priced more sensitive to swap rates, which are the rates that banks use to price mortgages. So here's an interesting figure that rates on five-year swaps, so five-year fixed-term products, are lower than two-year ones for the first time in 11 years. So that's why we're seeing this whole weird thing that anything longer than a one-year fixed rate is not really worth your while at the moment. Sure, there might be some restrictions on access, but Yorkshire Building Society will pay you a higher rate on an easy access product than multi-year fixed rate product. Yeah. It's very, very strange. A lot of it is due to competitive mortgage market pressure as well. You know, mortgage rates are rock bottom, so that's going to have an impact on savings rates. Basically, there is no, literally 0 point locking your cash away for longer than a year at the moment, which is probably good news for savers because we're in quite uncertain times and savers probably do want to keep their hands on their cash and get access to it whenever they want to. So it probably makes sense for both parties.
Okay, what else is good out there at the moment? What are we looking at?
Well, if you're talking in terms of easy access, of course, you know, Marcus Bank is actually a large reason in which... Good old Marcus. Remember this time last year, Georgie? God, we got
Happy
excited.
Happy birthday, Marcus.
Happy birthday,
it's
Marcus.
It's 1 year in September.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that has propped up the easy access savings market. It hasn't lowered the rate. It hasn't changed the rate. It's done exactly what it did in the States, which is just it went in with a rate and it's just stuck to that rate. That has meant that... Most, I would suggest, easy access money will just be going through Marcus, which is backed by Goldman Sachs. People will just be using it because the thing is with Easy Access, you know, if you're saving up and you need to dip into it for emergencies or that type of thing, it's perfect. If you've locked it away into a fixed rate account, it does exactly what it says in the tin. You can't get hold of that money. We're now in an unusual situation in which it doesn't really pay to lock away your money. Yeah. And if it does, it will be by a couple of percentage points. And, you know, we have the fixed rate tables that go 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 year. We always really warn against going towards the latter end of that because it's very hard to know what A will happen with rates, B, the rates aren't that great to justify a three, four, or five year rate. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, 1 or 2 year fixes aren't really much different to Easy Access. So it really isn't, there isn't that much point of going down the fixed rate route. And what a lot of savings providers do, you know, most banks and building societies take in savings in a very crude, you know, very easy to understand example of this, and this is there's way more factors of this, but they bring in savings, you know, traditionally bring in savings to then lend out, you know, that's what happened. What we're seeing at the moment is mortgage rates are incredibly low. They are ridiculously low. They are continuing to be ridiculously low. We're seeing a rise of people fixing over 5 years because they're so incredibly low. We've seen in the last couple of weeks two providers in the mortgage market are now offering a 15-year product, Virgin and Yorkshire Builders Society. 15-year fix, and it's a relatively low rate. It's incredible, Georgia. We're in a time now where I didn't think savings rates could probably head much lower, but with these rock bottom mortgage rates looking like they're going to stick around, I can't see where savings rates are going to increase. It's going to take some time.
But there is one little tip you can take if you want to boost that savings rate. So here's a riddle for you, Georgie. When is a Easy Access account bonus, not a bonus? It's when it's Marcus.
Wow.
So we're coming up.
What a riddle.
So basically, we're coming up. So we're coming up. You mentioned it's Marcus's birthday coming up. So anyone who took
me.
A, yeah.
I have one.
Oh, yes. You want to listen
Here
to
we
this?
Here we go. So if you, Georgie, and
you
if anyone.
You say that like I've not read all yeah. of This Is Money website daily. I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. So if you, Georgie, and anyone else listening takes nothing else away from this podcast apart from this, obviously take all of it away. But if you take one thing away from this, mm-hmm. take this away. So when you sign up for the Marcus account, you will know that it says 12-month bonus rate, 0.15%. So after a year, it'll drop to 1.35%. However, that is not really a bonus rate in the sense of you can't get it back. It's a three-minute process, and if you just click a button within your Marcus account, you can renew that rate another year because Marcus say that they want to treat existing and new customers all the same. So you can get 1.5%.
That's nice, isn't yeah. it?
Who says big banks don't treat savers very well? Well,
hang on, just a quick one before we move on to whether that's a nice thing or not, because Lee's face there. But what time do you have to do it? Because I opened mine, obviously this is about the listeners, but I opened mine in a couple of months, I think, away, like November time.
Well, I would imagine the best time to do it is just a few days before your initial rate is due to expire.
But you can do it any time.
But you can do it any time. You can do it now.
Oh, yeah.
Probably.
All right, then, Lee, you're right, taking over the...
What they'll do, they should write to you to let you know that the rate's dropping anyway, even though they made you aware of the bonus in the start. But let me put my cynical savings hat on here. Yes, it's all very nice, but A, why wouldn't they just not have a bonus? If they're going to do this, they could just keep it at 1.5% and not do this. Well, what it is that they are not hoping or relying, but some people just won't renew that rate
yeah.
to back to 1.5%. So they're hoping that probably like a good section of people will just, you know, inertia with savings accounts is rife. And putting my non-cynical hat on is that when Marcus launched this time last year, they might not have necessarily known, or of course they wouldn't have known what the landscape would be this time next year. So it might have been that they were then looking to perhaps now offer a 1.35% easy access rate, but they're still offering 1.5%. So when you dip your toe into a savings market, that's probably more like the explanation as to what it is, but it's well worth doing.
Yeah.
You know, what's the point of not? It takes a couple of minutes, and it can, even if you haven't got a huge sum of money in there, it's still a couple of quid extra in your pocket.
And also, if you read This Is Money and listen to this podcast, you now have no excuse not to do it because you've heard it twice.
Yeah, you hear, George. What's happened, though, is that no one's sort of jumping over Marcus. And Marcus, as we said when it launched this time last year, has such big financial backing that it can kind of stick around at the top of the tables. You know, we get a lot of challenger banks come in, they're just looking for a quick injection of cash and then they slip away very quickly. You know, Marcus Bank, it was just looking to gobble up cash, and it's had absolutely phenomenal response. And you know, you will get some people that just do not want to bank with Goldman Sachs Bank back product, which is fair enough. You know, we go back to the financial crisis, which we've been speaking about a bit on this podcast. People think about those days, and they're not necessarily keen to get an extra bit of interest because it's Goldman Sachs backed. So, you know, there are other options out there. It's just that Marcus Bank continues to be the best. I would like to see at some point someone leapfrog them, but I think what challenger banks are scared of is that they'll leapfrog Marcus and have such a huge influx of cash. And the other thing to point out about this, over the years, the last few years, the big battles have been over 1 year and 2 year fixed rates rather than easy access. Now, the reason behind that is challenger banks can know what they're going to do with that cash over the next year or the next 2 years and roughly how much is going to come in and be held in the accounts. Easy access is far more erratic. People put cash in, they pull cash out, they put cash in, they pull cash out. Nature of an easy access. So they can't justify and ring fence those funds and know where exactly where it's going unless you go big like Marcus has. So that is why 1 2 year fixed rate battle has really been largely where it's been focused on. But it seems that even Marcus is kind of killing that off a bit.
All right, finally, Lee, finally, because I know you've been excited about this one. Yeah, George rubbing his hands with glee there. Forget black, forget gold, the card you want. Clink, clink. For the ultimate bling is metal. Trendy digital banks N26, it sounds like a boy band, and Revolut offer metal cards for a premium, though. Apple, they launched their one in the US. Monzo, also planning to get on the action. The question, though, why?
Oh, Georgie, I've been... obviously, Simon's away. I have to write the weekly column, and I thought, I'm going to write about metal cards. I'm just, you know, bit silly season, summer. Yeah. But people care. Google Trends data that I had a look at this year has seen an explosion of people in Britain looking for metal bank cards. It's become the thing. So I would suggest that if you think about Monzo, it's been phenomenally popular. It's
got pink ones, aren't they?
Hot coral.
Hot coral, yeah.
Hot coral, right? So people, you wonder, you go around the London Underground, people are kind of holding them out like it's almost like a status symbol. Look at me, I'm with a new challenger bank, I'm with Monzo. But it looks like bubblegum colours are out and metal is in. So Monzo leaked some pictures of a metal card and it just sent its forum into meltdown. People wanting to know how they're going to get their hands on this metal card. As you say, N26 have got one at a premium. You know, it costs quite a bit of money. Monzo came out with a fee that people were unhappy with. You know, how much it would cost
per year. £75 1 year fee. But they're,
what?
It's
going to be a monthly thing, and they say there will be some benefits to it, but obviously the biggest benefit
more
is
than
probably
it being,
clink it.
Yeah,
more than it being metal, right?
Yeah, so that clink of when you put it down in a restaurant, I think that's what people are after. But a bit like Monzo in the beginning, when it's you see it around a little bit, and then you see everyone's got one. So what, everyone's just going to be around with a metal card and looking great with their metal card.
Everybody, I won't have one.
Neither. Well, the practicalities of it are... you know, they're not great for ATM machines.
They
get scratched.
Well, here's the funny thing, right? Is you know you've got the Apple card.
It seems a bit stupid for Apple. Well, it's thought Apple's all about tech.
Well, the thing is like the cashback bonus actually encourages you to use it to pay using Apple Pay rather than actually using the physical card. Yeah. And what doubly so is you're not even supposed to carry the card around. You can't even put it in your pocket because it gets scratched, it gets damaged. So you can't put it in your wallet. You can't really put it in an ATM. They've invented this thing that basically looks like a flex, and yet for some reason you're not supposed to carry it. You're supposed to just have it load up on your phone and pay for it that way.
It's the social media generation, Georgie. There's no details on the front of the card. You can look cool in your social media posts with your metal card. You know, it's kind of it's meant to be a bit of a sort of status symbol. And it is
no,
quite,
really,
yeah, it is. It's quite funny that Apple launched this one in the States. It's made of titanium, and they put out a guide on how to keep it clean. Yeah. The card and it can't come into contact with jean material. So you can't put it in your pocket, and it can't come into contact with leather, so you can't go in your wallet. So where on earth are you meant to put it?
In your glass cabinet at
home. And what a lot of people will do is get the card, won't use it, and they'll just use, you know, Apple Pay.
Yeah, that's the point,
using the phone. Yeah, but I mean, what's the point of having a metal card? It's zero point.
Just having some details on a card.
Well, it's the only one of the metal cards that you don't have to pay a monthly fee for, right? So, of course, you know.
It's when you go to the trendy cocktail bars and you just whip it out.
Yeah.
Your card.
But we should mention here, I don't know if you've seen the Fyre Festival documentary on Netflix. It is brilliant. If you haven't watched it, right? It's basically...
it's young and trendy, Lee. I won't have seen it. If it's not something sport-related, I won't have seen it.
There was a guy called Billy McFarland who teamed up with Ja Rule, the
rapper.
And they set up this like be-all and end-all festival. It was meant to be completely like mind-blowing somewhere on an island in Barbados.
Pablo Escobar's old island.
It was incredible. like on paper and all the glossy video and everything they made for it. But it turned out to be a complete and utter nightmare. But to go back to what Billy McFarlane did to become sort of a little bit famous in the first place or get some notoriety was he had a company called Magnesis where it would take your regular debit card and your current account, give you a link it to a metal card for $250 a year and give you exclusive access to membership and events and all that sort of thing. I thought people would watch that. It came out at the start of the year and go, God, that is so pretentious. A metal card. People actually thought they were high rollers, big time Charlies, because they had a metal card. But all it's done is it's made an appetite for it. However, you know, we can sit here and ridicule it, but people want one and they're looking to get one. Monzo are going to launch one and it's going to send people into meltdown. There's going to be a queue to get one. You know, you pay your money, you take your choice, don't you? If that's what you want, that's what you want.
You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you'd like to get in contact with us, any stories, if you have an example, if you have a metal card and you know what it's like, tell us.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can also comment on the bottom of the podcast story. And you can also follow us at This Is Money on Twitter.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate and review us on iTunes? It helps people find us.